This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Welfare Reform Act has done away with the guarantee of cash payments for low-income families with dependent children. My guest, David Zucchino, suspects that few of the senators and congressmen who voted for the bill had attempted to find out precisely what welfare recipients did with their government checks. In the months preceding the passage of the bill, Zucchino followed several unmarried welfare mothers living in North Philadelphia to find out more about their daily lives. His new book is called The Myth of the Welfare Queen. Earlier in the 90s, Zucchino covered that neighborhood for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's also been a foreign correspondent for the paper. He won a Pulitzer for his reporting from South Africa. He's now the Philadelphia Inquirer's foreign editor. I asked David Zucchino to describe the stereotype of the welfare queen.
The image of the welfare queen, I think, is someone who sits around all day watching soap operas, maybe sipping a little champagne and driving around in a Cadillac. It first came to public attention during the 76 campaign with Ronald Reagan, told a story that was proved to be apocryphal about a woman using many aliases to get benefits she wasn't entitled to, and she was definitely driving around in a Cadillac, at least according to the story that Ronald Reagan told, which was later proved to be not exactly true, exaggerated.
Now, did you start your book with the idea of dispelling the myth or investigating to see whether the myth actually correlated with reality?
I wanted just to see what the reality was. No, the idea was not to dispel the myth, but I had a pretty good idea after having covered North Philadelphia for 4 years. And this is an area that is heavily dependent on welfare, and I had a pretty good idea of how people manage their lives. And to some extent, the stereotype was true, but only for a small percentage of the population. The larger percent of the population was trying very hard just to struggle to get by.
A good deal of your book is devoted to the story of a woman named Odessa, who is a single mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, and raising many of her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Why did you choose her as the case study?
I had interviewed several people looking for someone who probably exemplified most closely what was happening in North Philadelphia, and the main reason I chose her is she had a real sense of responsibility and duty. And also, there was an intergenerational mix there. She was responsible not only for her children, but for her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren and an extended family. And I thought she personified a lot of what's happening in the inner cities in America, with women, particularly older women, being forced to take responsibility for the actions of their children and taking over the care of their grandchildren, which is a very common phenomenon in the inner city, as you know. And in her case, a number of people in her family, her daughters and granddaughters, had been abandoned by the fathers of their children and just left to fend for themselves, which really creates the whole problem of dependency. I mean, that's really where it starts. And she stepped in and took care of her grandchildren, who had been abandoned by their mother, who was a heavy cocaine user and a prostitute.
I'm wondering if, just within Odessa's family, if you saw any generational differences between her attitude toward welfare and her life on welfare and those of her children.
Right. Her attitude that it was a blessing. She's a very religious woman, and she believed that it came from God, and that she had a responsibility to work hard, to be worthy of welfare. Her children were sort of mixed. Some felt it was their right to have help from the federal government. Others took it but did not feel good about it, felt a little guilty, were trying to get off, were not happy being on. Her grandchildren, one of them in particular, had a real sense of entitlement and did fit the stereotype of someone who sat around all day and ate potato chips and watched TV, which is what she spent a lot of her life doing. And as I detail in the book, there's a lot of tension between Odessa and her granddaughter. She was taking care of one of her granddaughter's children because she didn't trust her in the care of her granddaughter. So there was a real mix, and you could see by generation how attitudes had shifted.
So I don't know, outside of this family, you do have a lot of experience covering the neighborhood you're writing about. Would you feel comfortable generalizing about generational differences in welfare?
In generally, people in their 50s have a real sense of the work ethic, I think. And somehow from that generation to the next generation of people in their 30s and 40s, that broke down. I would suspect it began with in the 60s when the problem of unwed mothers really got serious in this country, with men abandoning their women, and that seemed to change the attitude. And I think a lot of people in that generation felt that it was not their fault entirely that they were in the situation. They tended to blame society and factors beyond their control. And the generation now, young women, say, in their late teens and 20s, I think, have become so accustomed to welfare and to that sense of federal entitlement, it is hard to break it.
You're looking at the daily life of a woman and her family living on welfare. How much money did Odessa get each week and each year from welfare?
From AFDC, she got $201 every 2 weeks, so that's $400 a month. She had $87 a month in food stamps. That's fairly low, but she also had SSI, Social Security Program for for disabled people, low-income people. She got $490 a month from that, and another $490 a month for her grandson, who was born cocaine addicted because of the cocaine use by his mother. So she came out to about $16,000 a year, which was far higher than typical welfare person in North Philadelphia, most of whom are in the $8,000 to $10,000 a year range. And for a family of five, the poverty line is $17,000, so Odessa was slightly under that.
So who was she supporting on the $16,000 a year?
A lot of people. Four of her eight grown children depended on her to some extent for loans and for a place to live. They were constantly coming in and out with their children and moving in and staying with her because of various calamities in their lives. She had her own four grandchildren. She had seven great-grandchildren. She helped her elderly mother, who's in her 80s, who lives in Philadelphia. So she was really the rock upon which this family, this extended family of some 60 people, was built. And then again, from time to time, she has a son who's working in New Jersey as a contractor, and she relied on him for help from time to time. But for the most part, there were a number of people who really depended on her.
One of the questions that drove your new book, The Myth of the Welfare Queen, is what does a woman on welfare do in a typical day? How does she spend her time? Give us a sense of how Odessa spent her time on a typical day.
Yeah, I was really stunned, not only with Odessa, but with other people I follow, just how much time every day these people spent just on subsistence concerns, just on finding food, finding a place to live, getting around. Odessa's typical day, she would get up about 6 during the school year. She would get her four grandchildren ready to go to school. She would take care of usually some great-grandchildren who were there that had to have their diapers changed and had to be fed. Then she would go out, if it was time to pick up her welfare check. That's a process that involves a couple of hours of waiting in line. She would be running various family members to the doctor. She was constantly going to the doctor with sick kids or taking her mother to the doctor, taking other members of her family to the doctor. In a typical day, someone from her family or the neighborhood would come to her seeking help with a problem, and she would get taken off on that. She spent an incredible amount of time foraging for food, looking for bargains at food stores and things on sale, trying to find clothes for her family. She spent quite a bit of time, what she called trash picking, was going to neighborhoods in the suburbs of Philadelphia and looking through people's trash, and she basically furnished her entire house with cast-off sofas and VCRs and refrigerators. She clothed all her kids and her extended family with clothes she found there. Her own clothes came from trash picking. And usually she didn't get through with what I call her job, which was her daily life, until 9 or 10 at night after she had cooked dinner for all her grandkids and for any other relatives who were staying with her. So she ends up putting in 16 hours a day.
Would you say that a lot of the people in Odessa's neighborhood were on welfare too?
Oh, yeah. At least half.
Were there ways in which the neighborhood revolved around welfare and welfare checks in the mail?
Oh, yeah. You could see the days when people got their checks because they would be out making purchases, and they come every 2 weeks, and it's on a staggered system. There's not one day when everyone gets their check. But people, well, the first thing they did when they got their check was to repay loans that they had gotten from people of a few dollars. There's this constant system going of whether you know the day that your neighbor gets her welfare check, so you know when she's going to be flush, so you'll borrow money and pay it back when you get your check.
What else would happen on days when checks arrive?
People would make purchases. They would go to the corner store and buy their food for the next several days. In Odessa's case, she would set up a budget for the next 2 weeks and head out first and buy meat and enough frozen meat to last for a couple of weeks, depending on what store had the best sale. She would set aside some for her kids' snack money that she gave them to go to school every day. And then she would hand out little bits of money to various relatives who are in need, who knew what day she was going and who would suddenly appear.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Zucchino, and he's written a new book called The Myth of the Welfare Queen. And he's also the foreign editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with David Zucchino for several years, he covered the community of North Philadelphia and wrote a lot about drugs and welfare in that community. And now he's written a new book called The Myth of the Welfare Queen. One of the phenomena that you write about in your book is that on the day that food stamps come in the mail, there are guys who are known now as stamp men who come around and offer about, 70 cents on the dollar?
50 to 70 cents, right.
For food stamps. And so for people who need cash in a hurry, for instance, people who need cash to buy drugs in a hurry, they'll sell their food stamps for 50 to 70 cents on the dollar and get the cash that they need. What was the attitude in the neighborhood about the stamp men?
I think a lot of people were like Odessa, who really despised these people and felt that they gave people on welfare a very bad name. Other people obviously were more than happy to take advantage of it, even though they gave up half the value of the food stamps. I mean, they weren't interested in the food. These were people on drugs. Drug addiction is an incredibly serious problem. I mean, it's overwhelming in that neighborhood. And people, you know, there was a demand there, and the stamp men met it. They're very, very common. You'll see them outside welfare offices once a month when the food stamps come in, and you'll see people gladly, you know, giving up half the value just for a little bit of cash.
And what do the stamp men do with this? Do they then turn around and sell the stamps, or they use it to buy more food?
Yeah, or they can redeem them with a lot of merchants are willing just to take yet another cut of it and give them cash. And there were some drug gangs that'll even accept food stamps, you know, at, you know, 40 or 50 cents on the dollar as payment for drugs. And another thing the drug dealers will do is advance drugs in return for holding on to your welfare ID card until it's time for check day in 2 weeks, and then they accompany you down to the office and give you the card, and when you come out, they get their money back and you get your card back.
The neighborhood that you followed for The Myth of the Welfare Queen is a neighborhood you wrote about for several years for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and you did many stories in that period of time about the impact of drugs, specifically crack, on the neighborhood and, you know, on the young people of the neighborhood. What are some of the ways that the whole drug system affects daily life in the neighborhood?
Yeah, the illegal narcotics trade really has permeated all of North Philadelphia. You've got just thousands of kids who earn a living by selling drugs on commission, and when that money goes home, you know, it buys food, it buys sneakers, it buys clothes. A lot of people, and including middle-aged and elderly people, will let drug dealers hide the stashes in their homes. There's a really thriving underground economy of people who sell pipes, who sell syringes. There's prostitutes who feed off the drug trade, who offer sex in return for a certain amount of drugs. As I write in the book, there was hardly a family in North Philadelphia that I came in contact with that didn't have some connection directly or indirectly and who did not benefit from the drug trade. The DEA estimates that about $250 million a year in cash flows through North Philadelphia as a direct result of drugs.
It's an incredible paradox. The drugs that are tearing apart the neighborhood are also the only prospering economy in the neighborhood. So a lot of people a lot of people who aren't drug dealers are actually making money off of it, because I guess it's just about the only economy there.
It's the only functioning economy, and welfare is the other source of income. It's not an economy, but it's the other. Those are the two main sources of income, and drugs are just everywhere, and a lot of people tolerate them because it's, first of all, it provides employment. It's a great source of employment for particularly young kids, and a lot of people get wealthy and pour their money into the neighborhood. A lot of the drug dealers will start up small businesses, mainly for the purpose of laundering money, but at least it provides some business. And obviously, the bodegas and these mom-and-pop grocery stores and beauty salons and video stores all rely on the income from drugs that people spend on these kind of services. So it really flows deeply into the society.
Based on the research that you did for your book, The Myth of the Welfare Queen, what would you say are some of the greatest misconceptions that a lot of people have about people on welfare?
Right. One is that they think that people on welfare have all this abundance of free time and all this leisure time, when in fact people are on the go constantly, I mean every moment, just trying to get food, trying to deal with the bureaucracy, which is very difficult. There are a lot of requirements under state welfare laws of documents that need to be provided, and you need to keep updating your status. Finding clothing, just doing the day-to-day things that come pretty easily for middle-class people who have a car, who have access to nice grocery stores and department stores and don't have to worry about you know, how much money they have that particular day. It's very, very time-consuming. I think another misconception that people have is that people want to be on welfare and enjoy being on welfare, and I found nobody who would admit to that. Maybe obviously there are some people who will take advantage of the system and don't mind being on welfare, but the vast majority of people I talked to would just love to have a job. The only thing they wanted was to have a job and have a little money and then not have to be dependent on this system. There's an example that I cite in the book. When a hotel was going up here in Philadelphia, they advertised for 500 and some jobs, and on the day that the jobs were available, 10,000 people showed up. I mean, that's a pretty good indication that people do want to work.
You wrote this book, you know, a case study in the welfare system just before the welfare reform bill was passed, which will completely change how welfare functions in the United States. So looking at the system right before the bill changing welfare, what would you say were some of the things that you thought obviously worked and obviously didn't work?
Right. The one thing that didn't work was this sense of lifetime availability of welfare, that the generation of young women do have that mentality, I think. Not all of them, but some, that it was going to be there forever and that they could have babies and have them covered by the government, and made them less inclined, I think, to chase after their boyfriends and the fathers of their children for child support. That part of the system was not working very well. I think what really needs to be done under the new system, and it's not being provided for, is some sort of help with child care, which is a huge problem for mothers who are trying to find a job and go to work. There's no one to leave, especially mothers of young children. There's no one to leave them with. Transportation is a huge problem. I think only about 10% or less of people on AFDC have access to a car. If you're going to get a job, there are no jobs, almost no jobs in North Philadelphia. You have to go out to the suburbs where there are jobs. But even if you can get the fare for the subway and the train, it leaves you at a suburban station. And how do you get to your job from there? So I think these are the kind of problems that aren't dealt with really seriously under the new law. And I'm afraid a lot of these people are going to be set adrift, even if they have the strongest desire in the world to get a job and they go through job training programs. Just the practical necessities of life and housing. With some of the people in the book were homeless and going from house to house. There's really no provision above and beyond existing housing help, you know, to help people find a stable place to live before they can even think about getting a job.
How do you think the new welfare reform will affect the daily lives of the people who you followed?
Well, for the first 2 years, it might not make so much difference, but when that deadline starts coming and they will be cut off from their benefits and required to go to work, they'll have to take that two-year period and get ready to find child care, to find a place to live, to find transportation to work, to get into a job training program. It's going to completely turn their lives upside down, and I just don't think a lot of these people have the wherewithal. to come up with that kind of help on their own. There's going to be increased reliance, I think, on friends and family members, particularly finding somebody to take care of your children during the day. If they're preschool children, even children in school, to have somebody at home to get the kids when they come back. I think what the law doesn't recognize is that the people that welfare is for are children, not the mothers. Of the, I think, 11.5 million people that were on AFDC as of earlier this year, 8 point some million were children. So we're not talking about a whole lot of adults, even though the debate in Washington during the welfare reform bill was completely on the mothers, whereas the children obviously are the ones who are going to be affected. And I just think it's wrong to hold the children responsible for the actions of their parents. And it puts an incredible amount of pressure on parents who want to do the right thing to get out and completely revamp their lives in 2 years.
David Zucchino, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Zucchino's new book is The Myth of the Welfare Queen. He's the foreign editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.